It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
U.S. military special operation forces commandeer a rogue oil tanker. Tunisia claims to have killed a dangerous Islamist militant in a shootout. I'm Victor Beatty, reporting from Washington. The Libyan government has thanked the United States for a Navy special forces operation that stopped an oil tanker from exporting illicitly obtained crude oil. The U.S. Defense Department said Monday U.S. Navy SEALs took control of the tanker while it was in international waters near Cyprus. The vessel is now returning to Libya. A Pentagon statement said no one was injured in the boarding of the stateless vessel seized earlier this month by three armed Libyans. U.S. spokesperson Jen Psaki Monday said the action was taken at the request of the Libyan and Cypriot governments and approved by President Obama.
This was a request that came from the government of Libya, and we, of course, responded to that. In terms of the legal question, I'd have to check on that specifically, but we responded to their specific request. And more broadly speaking, we, of course, don't want to live in a world where armed individuals or groups are able to seize vessels and threaten people's lives and sell stolen cargo for their own financial gain.
The vessel, known as the Morning Glory, loaded the oil in the Libyan port of As-Sidra while it was controlled by a rebel militia that seeks more autonomy for eastern Libya. The tanker evaded Libyan naval forces, prompting a backlash against Prime Minister Ali Zidane, who was forced from office by the National Assembly. A car bomb exploded outside a military base in the eastern city of Benghazi Monday, killing at least 9 soldiers, wounding several others. The blast went off at the gates to the El Rabba base just as troops left following an inauguration ceremony for new officers. Captain Imad El-Faidi said about 11 a.m. local time, we heard an explosion from inside the base. We came out and found a car that had exploded, causing damage to several vehicles and saw many casualties. Benghazi, the birthplace of the 2011 uprising that led to the downfall of longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi, has seen a sharp rise in attacks and assassinations targeting security forces and foreigners. The Tunisian government says security forces Monday killed at least 3 suspected Islamist militants and arrested 6 other people in a raid on a house in northwest Chindouba region near the Algerian border. The suspected militants were linked to an attack last month that left at least 4 dead, including 2 policemen. Interior Ministry spokesman Mohammed Ali Arroy said, based on intelligence information concerning the presence of suspected terrorist Raghib Hanechi, who was believed to be involved in a February 16 attack in Chindouba, we found he was among those at the home of one of the militants. Algerian troops had killed 7 suspected militants who had crossed over from Tunisia last week. Al-Qaeda-linked militants are believed to have used Tunisia's Chambi Mountains as a refuge point. Much of the violence in recent years has been blamed on the group Ansar al-Sharia, a hardline Salafist group, blamed for the killing of 2 opposition politicians last year. A new vaccine being developed by an international consortium of scientists to prevent the often fatal East Coast Fever, or ECF, in cattle could influence human malaria and cancer research. Fish Neen, director of the International Livestock Research Institute's East Coast Fever Program, said the vaccine project comes as a welcome boost after years of indifference to the disease.
The disease, I should say, is present in about 12 countries in the region. It's only present in sub-Saharan Africa. It doesn't occur anywhere else. And so the disease is of particular interest to Africa, but because it only affects the African continent, there's not been as much emphasis placed on research on this disease. But the vaccine is produced from live infected ticks.
Neen says the vaccine has saved hundreds of thousands of cattle, but is very difficult to produce, takes time, and is expensive. The disease threatens as many as 28 million head of cattle in East and Central Africa. The UN Security Council has demanded a withdrawal of all armed forces from the troubled Abyei region claimed by both Sudan and South Sudan. The Council Monday expressed grave concern about the security and humanitarian situation in the region and condemned recent clashes there. It demands South Sudan withdraw numerous militia forces from Abyei and for Sudan to withdraw its oil police officers from the region. The UN has a peacekeeping force in the 10,000 square kilometer region, which is prized by both countries for its fertile land and oil reserves. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. Some of these stories can be found and read online at our website, voanews.com.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 18th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria's long-awaited national conference opened Monday in Abuja.
This is a conference about the future of Nigeria. This is a conference about the politics of Nigeria itself, not about political ambitions or re-election.
Ruben Abate is a spokesman for Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan. Ghanaian officials warn of inadequate mental health care in the country. Senegalese singer Youssou N'Dour endorses President Macky Sall for re-election. And South Sudan's government denies it is arresting and detaining journalists for their reporting.
Some media are acting very irresponsibly, like those who are actually publishing articles written by rebels, and even those radios who actually talk about and make interview to rebels, saying that we are going to capture this city or that. These are some of the things that the law will have to deal with them.
Attorney Work Attorney is the spokesman for South Sudan's President Salva Kiir. A Zimbabwe municipality owes its workers more than $10 million in unpaid salaries, and we'll look at the civilian impact of the recent military offensive against Somalia's Al-Shabaab. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigeria's long-awaited national conference opened Monday in the capital, Abuja. For the next 3 months, the nearly 500 delegates from the country's ethnic, religious, and linguistic divide will attempt to find solutions to the many problems plaguing the country. Those problems include the ongoing Boko Haram threat, corruption, and sharing of oil revenue. In his speech to open the conference, President Goodluck Jonathan told the delegates to put partisan politics aside and focus on the agenda of the country. Presidential spokesman Ruben Abate tells me President Jonathan urged the delegates to build a stronger and more united Nigeria.
The president made a number of points. One, he made it very clear that he has no personal agenda to pursue through this conference, because there have been some speculations, particularly among the opposition, that the president is not sincere about the conference or that this has something to do with some kind of political agenda. What is important through this conference, he made very clear, is a national interest. And he enjoined all the delegates to the conference to ensure that they focus strictly not on narrow partisan interests, not to use the platform of the conference for the pursuit of divisive politics or ethnic jingoism, but to put Nigeria first. President Jonathan went for that, to say that this particular conference should provide us an opportunity for further strengthening the bonds that tie us together. One major refrain throughout his speech was togetherness, was national unity, was patriotism.
There are those who say that the country continues to drift more and more apart along ethnic, political, and religious lines. And there are some people who are suggesting perhaps is the country gradually drifting towards disintegration where you have a divided Nigeria.
The unity of Nigeria is not threatened. If anything, Nigeria remains a united country. And in the speech that President Jonathan delivered on that occasion, he stressed the point that the amalgamation was not a mistake, that we are a country of ethnic diversity, of linguistic diversity, of great diversity. That our unity, the beauty of our country, lies in fact in that diversity. And that we've been together for 100 years in spite of whatever challenges we may have faced. But those challenges have strengthened us. Those challenges have compelled us to continue to look for solutions as to how to continue to move our country forward.
The president, he's been quoted as saying that the delegates should tackle the country's burning issues. And one of those issues right now is the issue of the Islamist-linked violence that has been plaguing Nigeria.
Well, the president did not dictate an agenda to the conference. The issues that he referred to in his speech, these are the issues that have been out there in the public domain. It doesn't amount to the president setting an agenda.
One of the issues that has caused this tension, particularly within the ruling party, is the president's decision to seek re-election and now the formation of other parties or splinter groups from the ruling party. That is not something that the conference is going to deal with.
No. If there's any point that President Jonathan, it may be clear that, look, the conference is a conference of the Nigerian people. It's not a conference about partisan politics, but that the national interest, the national agenda the Nigerian agenda will be what will predominate. And if you look at the composition of that conference, you see that it's not constructed along political lines. It is a conference about the future of Nigeria. It is a conference about the politics of Nigeria itself.
Ruben Abate is the spokesman for Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan. He was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. Ghana's chief psychiatrist says he's worried about the inadequate mental health care delivery system in the country. Dr. Kwasi Ose said the existing mental health institutions only receive about 40% of their yearly budgetary needs, which he says affects the smooth running of health institutions. Dr. Ose tells reporter Peter Clarty that incentives are needed to attract well-qualified professionals to mental health care facilities across the country.
The situation of mental health care in the country has not been good for a very long time. Fortunately, we put in measures to address it. But the situation as at now is that our mental health care is largely centralized, and that means all our mental health facilities are located down south of the country. So the northern part, the middle belt, the northern part of the country does not have any proper mental health care facility. There are three psychiatric hospitals, and all are within Accra and 2-3 hours drive from Accra. Our mental health care is fraught with financial challenges. Every now and then we don't have money. We cry for money to be able to feed our patients and to get the necessary logistics that we require to serve the mentally ill. The whole country of 25 million almost, we have just 14 psychiatrists, meaning roughly one psychiatrist per 2 million. That certainly is woefully inadequate. We have just about 700 nurses, psychiatric nurses, when we require not less than 4,000 psychiatric nurses.
Looking at the critical situation and the concerns that you have raised, what is the best way forward? How can the government and the private industry help partner to improve mental health care delivery in Ghana?
Fortunately, it's a very simple question and a very simple answer. The simple answer is that all these challenges I've mentioned have a single linkage. They are all rooted on a system. That system is we don't have the proper state-of-the-art legislation to deal with it. So we've couched a state-of-the-art mental health law, our new Mental Health Act, Act 846 of 2012, which was enacted only 8 months ago. All that is left is the implementation. Now, once you begin to implement this law, it has within it the remedy, in fact, the panacea for mental health care challenges that we have in the country. So all that we need to do is just simply implement it. And you'll be asked, how would the implementation solve it? The mental health law says that we should establish a mental health fund. It talks about establishment of a fund, and I've talked about financial situation, which is a major handicap.
What about the issue of cultural stigma associated with mental health issues? How can this be addressed?
We recognize that the cultural issues may look entrenched, but they can easily be discarded through constant engagement with the people and education. If you engage them, you let them see the harmful effect of a particular cultural practice, and you give the alternative, they are prepared to accept the alternative. But if you don't give them the alternative, that is where you have a problem. So we propose, in fact, a whole division of the new Mental Health Act will be to engage the traditional rulers, the opinion leaders, and others in this exchange of ideas.
Dr. Kwasi Ose is Ghana's chief psychiatrist. He spoke with reporter Peter Clarty from the capital, Accra. One of Senegal's most famous musicians, Youssou N'Dour, says he will be supporting incumbent President Macky Sall for re-election in 2017. N'Dour ran for president in 2012. Although he left his option open for a possible future race, observers say N'Dour's statement indicates he would not run for the post in the next election. Political analyst Ali Njai tells Ricky Shryak that for now, N'Dour has his sight on the office of mayor of the capital, Dakar.
We think that it's important to endorse the current president and to support him for a second term, given the fact that they fought together and the same goal. So he will delay his 2017 candidacy until later. He will postpone it until maybe later.
He says he may run in the future then, but not in this next
year. Yes, may run in the future, but not 2017.
He mentioned as well that the failure of the Macky Sall regime, if there is one, will be to not support development enough for the poorest of the country. Is that true?
Yes, yes.
What does he mean by that, considering the fact that Macky Sall, you know, just passed a decrease in rental prices all over Senegal that affected the poorest of the poor? You know, do you think that's the case, actually?
Yeah, I think that's the case. Because, you know, President Macky Sall's political agenda, one thing very important, he's trying to... He has decided for the first time to give some allowance to the poorest of the country. About 250,000 poorest households will receive some funding from the government. I think it is about $200 a year.
He was also, I guess, asked about Senegal's laws against homosexuality, and he asked Europe not to stop imposing their points of view on Africa. Do you think this is also in the same reign as what Macky Sall had said?
Yes. When you can do is saying that, because the reality is, a lot of people in our Africa and in Asia are not really ready to accept open gay wedding and open lesbian relations. So that's why President Macky, when he was not very clear in his position before the election, most of the religious leaders was against him. And when President Obama was here, he used his opportunity to clarify his position. And what he's really saying is, yes, people, the Western have not had to impose their view on homosexuality to our country. Going back to his point of view about 2017 election, I mean, people have to understand that Yusuf's agenda now is to try to become the mayor of Dakar.
Youssou N'Dour wants to be the mayor of Dakar.
Yes, and he says that he cannot be the mayor of Dakar without being endorsed and backed by President Macky Sall's party. So it looked like he's trying to say to President Macky Sall, if you make me the candidate of the leading coalition in the city of Dakar, I'll be willing to run out for my presidential ambition and give you a chance to have a second chance.
And what kind of influence does the mayor of the capital have over national politics?
The mayor of Dakar is the most powerful political position in Senegal after the president's.
That was Senegalese political analyst Ali Njai speaking to Ricky Shryak from Dakar, Senegal. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 18th. And please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. The spokesman for President Salva Kiir is denying that journalists are being arrested or detained in South Sudan based on their reporting. Attorney Work Attorney insists that no journalists have been arrested under the Kiir administration.
To be honest with you, national security has never actually questioned any journalists, because what I know, all the journalists that are accredited here to South Sudan, whenever they have any problem with the national security, they always call me. I have not received any calls regarding anyone that has been stopped by national security. If there is anything that has led into certain journalists coming to national security, you know, it is just to receive an advice, because some journalists are actually very irresponsible, and they write very irresponsibly.
And these journalists are also saying the line is not drawn clearly. And most of the time they are saying once they report on activities of the rebels, they are being accused of supporting the rebels.
One of the very fundamental things in journalism is for the journalists themselves to look at what the effect of their journalism allow them to say and what not to report. If we say the truth, you look at the fact that any country in the world, and you know those foreign journalists who come to South Sudan to work in the field of journalism, should also think when they are trying to say something, they should think in line of the laws that govern their own countries. And they try to avoid things that can incite citizens or things that can threat national security. Like last time, a Jazeera journalist was reporting, saying that the rebels are within 60 miles to Juba, which has caused panic. And that was not the case in the ground. That's why he was actually asked to leave the country.
My understanding is that you are saying that the government in South Sudan is not harassing journalists. Is that what you're telling me?
The government is not harassing journalists. But it is the journalists who are even very irresponsible, to the extent that the government at the end of the day must have to ensure that the media law goes to the parliament so that it is passed into the bill, so that it regulates the media, because some media are acting very irresponsibly, like those who are actually publishing articles written by rebels, and even those radios who actually talk about and make interview to rebels, you know, saying that we are going to capture this city or that. You know, these are some of the things that, you know, the law will have to deal with them. And it is good for the journalists to ensure that they look into that effect.
Yeah, they are doing that in the name of freedom of speech that is enshrined in South Sudan's constitution.
Well, the freedom of speech is not free. Even in the Western world, I am trained in England. I was in England. And I have seen a number of people being arrested during the Iraqi war. So this is not the first time. So you cannot tell me about the freedom of speech. That is limitless. All the freedom of speech has limitations.
That was South Sudan presidential spokesman Atene Wek Atene speaking with John Tanza of South Sudan program in focus. In Zimbabwe, the Chitungwizi municipality, located about 30 kilometers south of the capital, Harare, is said to owe its workers more than $10 million in unpaid salaries. The Workers' Committee told Parliament on Monday that while ordinary workers are getting poorer, senior management are paid on time and in some instances giving salary advances. Ivan Chifera of the VOA Zimbabwe program reports from Harare.
Chitungwiza Municipality Workers Committee Chairman Ephraim Katsina told the Public Service, Labor and Social Welfare Portfolio Committee, workers have gone for 11 months without pay, while senior management, who get hefty salaries and allowances, get their money on time. He said, though Town Clerk George Makunde and his management team claim they are also owed money by council, the committee's evidence, including bank statements, showing management is fully paid and has been advanced salaries, some of them up to May this year. Katsina handed over the bank statement to the committee as evidence.
A case in point is payments made to the town clerk, Mr. George Makunde, in March 2013. From the bank statement from Metbank, Mr. Makunde was paid $6,500 in his ZB account. That was on the 22nd of March 2013. Yet his payslip for the same month indicates his salary was $4,084.25. And in January, Mr. Jim Makunde, the town clerk, his payslip also indicated $4,084.25, but at the bank you got $10,000.
Katsina told lawmakers senior management salaries were no longer being processed by the town council salaries officer, adding the human resources director is now in control, a move he said was designed to hide information from the workers. Katsina said the committee will investigate the municipality's finances to make sure employees are paid their outstanding salaries. He said workers have evidence that the council collected $14 million from January 2013 to date and only $4 million was used for employment costs, while the rest cannot be accounted for. He explains service delivery is also suffering as a result of this financial mismanagement.
What I'm saying is that we don't see evidence of service delivery, but they've collected more than 14 million.
Both town clerk George Makunde and Mayor Mutoti could not be reached for comment. Findings by a special investigations team appointed by the local government ministry revealed the non-payment of Chitungwiza town council workers induced them into deals with some businessmen where they illegally sold council land to desperate home seekers. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Somalia says the ongoing military offensive in south-central Somalia against al-Shabaab is having a big humanitarian impact because it is taking place at a time when farmers in the area are preparing for planting their crops ahead of the rainy season. Spokesman Abdi Nuo Yusuf says at least 6,000 people have been displaced so far since the recent offensive began.
According to an assessment, an inter-agency assessment that was done on 5th of March, we have been told that there is need for shelter, for water, for food, for health services. These are the immediate needs for these displaced people in Baidoa, particularly those who fled from the towns in Bakor region and the surrounding villages. Currently, there's responses going on, however little it is. On 11th of March, the humanitarian agencies operating there delivered some assistance to approximately 660 families, and more will be delivered, and particularly not only in Baidoa, but in other areas which are accessible to the humanitarian community or the humanitarian agencies, and we're going to step up our efforts in the coming days, looking at the bigger picture of access of these areas.
On the reasons behind the displacement, were they forced to flee by the retreating forces or because of the incoming offensive?
According to our own assessment, they have been displaced for the fear of maybe a possible confrontation between the government forces and arms on one side and the other group. Therefore, maybe people have predicted that maybe this will happen, and preemptively they had to leave those towns or those villages, at least temporarily, until the situation settles.
Were these people relying on humanitarian aid or were they farmers?
Definitely, the larger part of the population rely on humanitarian aid. There are those who are farmers. Also, the other fear that we have actually is the offensive is now started at a time when people are waiting for the main rain. The good rains will start maybe in April. Therefore, this is the time people use to prepare for planting their farms in preparation for the good rain. Therefore, if it continues into April and beyond, then maybe the farming communities will be affected in these areas, particularly where these conflicts are going on.
Abdi Noor Yusuf is spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Somalia. He was speaking with Haroon Maruf of VOA Somali program. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Bronze medalists Ghana play Germany in a Group B fixture at the FIFA Women's Under-17 World Cup in Liberia, Costa Rica, today, Tuesday. A win will guarantee Ghana a place in the second round, having won their opening match. Meanwhile, in a clash of tournament debutants in the capital, San Jose, Zambia need to beat Venezuela to get their campaign back on track after they lost their opening match. Meanwhile, Algerian Jamel Belmadi has been appointed coach of the Qatar national team, the Qatar Football Association revealed in Doha on Monday. Belmadi had a measure of success at club football in Qatar over the past decade and is charged with qualifying the Qatar for the 2018 World Cup in Russia. Turning to athletics, Ethiopian Jacob Jarso ran a lifetime best of 2 hours, 6 minutes and 17 seconds to win the Seoul International Marathon in the South Korean capital on Sunday. Kenyan runner-up Stephen Chemlani also achieved a personal best of 2 hours, 6 minutes and 24 seconds, while third-placed Kenyan Gilbert Kirwa was 20 seconds adrift. Meanwhile, Hela Kiprop of Kenya won the women's race in a personal best of 2 hours, 27 minutes and 29 seconds. Ethiopian Ashu Kasim was second, while Namibian Hilaria Johannes was third. In New York, Kenyans Geoffrey Mutai and Sally Jepkoskei Kipyego carried the day at the New York City Half Marathon on Sunday. Finally, in motorsports, Ivory Coast's Gary Cheney and navigator Romain Comas won the Bandama Motor Rally in Abidjan, Ivory Coast on Sunday. Another Ivory Coast crew of Morifere Soumaoro and Philippe Garcia were runners-up ahead of the French entry of Marc Molin and Christian Tribute. Each crew drove a Mitsubishi Lancer Evo. The Bandama Motor Rally is the first event in the 2014 Africa Motor Rally Championship Series. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here is our listener mail for this Tuesday morning, March 18th.
This is the fourth time we're having such a national conference that has brought nothing to this nation. But the most disheartening thing is that each of the 492 participants in this conference are going to be paid 4 million naira each, making 12 million naira per participant in the three-month conference. What are they going to talk about that they are going to be paid much as 12 million per person? It's just a wastage of the national resources when many people cannot boost of $5 in a day. My name is Ayodele Olujide Oke. I call from Ibadan in Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. And that's it for this Tuesday, March 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the crew, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa.